Hi guys, welcome to the review session for exam 2, which I'll be leading. And first off, a few reminders. Exam 2 is this coming Monday, the 25th. Hopefully I got the date right. And for local students, as before, it'll be in place of lecture, 5:30 to 7:30 at Harvard Hall 104. And for distance students, you know, you have your remote proctoring. Hopefully you've already got that proctoring thing down. The exam will be 2 hours, as is the length of the lecture, and it'll be closed book and paper and writing utensil, pen, pencil, eraser, whatever you use to write. So no like laptops and iPods or stuff like that. Okay, so as before, I've sort of condensed the study tips. Really, really big tip, know the lectures. Really, really know the lectures. And then try the practice exam so you can get an idea of your iffier areas. And practice is always good, right? You can go tell your friend or your, you know, your family or something about the concepts that you're going to be tested on and that I'm going to briefly go over. And you can also try some web coding if you're kind of afraid of, like, what am I going to be asked about HTML? What tags do I need to know or something like that? Or how do the tags work? Try some coding on your own. More of a fun exercise than maybe, I don't know, a studying exercise, but cool. So here's our agenda. I've sort of broken down the topics into, you know, little blocks that I'm going to talk about. Forgot Scratch here. Oops, but I'll be talking about that too. Yay! So let's start. Let's talk about multimedia. Possibly my favorite or second favorite chunk of the four. So let's talk about images. What are they made out of? Like, how does it work? Images are pretty much a grid of pixels. So something sort of like that, except pixels are really, really small. So I guess made it really big here. Or my example is, you know, very big. And then a pixel is a small square cell or a dot on screen in the image. And then each of those pixels represent a color. So you can sort of think of, like, say I have a grid and you know, I colored my pixels that way, it makes up an image. Happy face, yay! And so for the color that each of them represent, there's different color models. The one we talked about in class was RGB, or red, green, blue. And this describes the color sort of in bits, or bit depth. And so what do I mean by this? I think example is probably best. If you have an 8-bit depth, then that means each pixel has 8 bits to represent color. What does this mean in terms of math? Well, since each bit can either be a 1 or a 0, you take 2 raised to the 8th, and that gives you 256 distinct colors with an 8-bit depth. Yay! Hopefully not too hard. Hopefully not too scary. And then just a bit of jargon, I guess, if you want to call it that. Pixel resolution is pretty much, in general, the pixel count. And this can be either in terms of the width of the image times the height, and that will be in pixels, so like 500 pixels times 1,000 pixels. So it'd be like 500 width and then 500, or 1,000 height in pixels. Or it can also be the total number of pixels in the image. So that could be like if your camera takes 10 megapixel images, then every image it takes, like the whole thing contains 10 megapixels. So there are two things we might be referring to if we talk about pixel resolution. And resolution in general is just the amount of detail in like an image. Yay! Questions? Yes?
Okay, so a pixel is every square.
Yep.
And every square has 256 colors?
Each square here, if you have an 8-bit depth, each square would have the potential to display 256 colors. Yes. So like all colors at once would be kind of weird. But yes, so pixel resolution, I guess here if we want to find out the pixel resolution, it'd be something like, let me start counting these squares. Oh, where's my, okay. It's 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So this is 7, the width, 7 pixels by 6, I think, 6 pixels height. So 7 times 6 is 42. So it'd be 42 pixels, like, in total. Yay! Cool. Question time! Ha ha ha, so early. Pop quiz, no, kidding. So, how many bits does each pixel have for color with a 24-bit depth? Kind of softball.
Is it 17?
Yes? Not quite. You're jumping ahead there. I'm asking about how many bits does each pixel have for color? Not. Pardon?
Three.
Three what? 3 bits? 3 bytes, yes. So each pixel has 24 bits or 3 bytes to make color. And if you wanted to figure out how many colors would be possible, you'd take 2 raised to the 24, which is, you know, what you sort of said, like 16.5 million, something like that. Is that the next question? Hey, what do you know? That's the next question. So I already told you the answer. But yeah, so each bit has, each pixel has 24 bits, and using those 24 bits, you can convey 16.7 million different colors. Distinct colors, I guess, would be more accurate. Yay, math! Not really my friend, but hopefully yours. Questions? Okay. So let's keep on talking about images. There are 2 types. If you'll recall from lecture, the 2 types are raster or bitmap, not to be confused with the bitmap like file format, and vector. Do you guys recall which is which or what any of them do? Guess I'll just tell you. So raster or bitmap is literally a map of bits, or a map of bits. So everything's all static. And vector is when you have an image created from calculated math formulas. So you have a bunch of formulas, and the program or whatever's displaying it calculates the size of the shape or the color according to those formulas, and then displays it for you. So in terms of quality, raster is lossy. I'll go back to this in a little bit. But that means that if you resize it or you like alter it in certain ways, it'll get kind of fuzzy. You'll lose some quality. Vector is lossless. I'll go back to that in a bit as well. But if you resize it, if you make it bigger, if you make it smaller, if you sort of change it, there's pretty much no distortion because it's all math formulas, right? So if you made something, twice the size, you just sort of, factored that into your math, and then it comes out, yay, looking all crisp and nice. Versus, I'm gonna Photoshop it and make this raster image, twice the size, and then the math doesn't quite, you'll get some fuzziness. Questions on this? Anticipating a question time? Question time! Yes?
You're using lossy in a different way in which we used it in the past, because we mm-hmm. talked about particular format saving mm-hmm. being lossy in class. Mm-hmm. And we talked about a TIFF or a raw file not being lossy. But those are both raster type files. Mm-hmm. What you're saying here is that those raster files are lossy, but I think what you're specifying is that we try to change it. Mm-hmm. So I just want a clarification.
Okay.
Or if we could ask a question about what lossy mm-hmm. means on the test, which definition are we going to get?
Okay, so the question was lossy versus lossless. How do they apply in terms of, I guess, file compression versus an image? I used it
for a raw is not a compressed file.
For a pardon?
Is not a compressed file.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a raster file.
Yeah, well, I was using it loosely in terms of whether or not if you resized it, you would lose data. Sort of would you have the original, or would you sort of lose some data? Yeah. Okay, if we go past this slide. Do you guys want to answer? What would be better for logos, photos, and t-shirt designs? Do you guys get this? Because I think, here we go, lossy versus lossless. So lossless is when you try to get it back, you get exactly the original. And an example would be sort of run length encoding for the GIF. That's when he showed us the flags with vertical stripes or horizontal stripes. Here's a more simple version, in my opinion, or maybe less technical version. Where's my counter? So here, say you had a line of pixels representing white and black, and then how you would sort of encode this, or losslessly encode it, would be like you would count all the W's, all the white pixels you have, and remember that. So you have 11, and then you have 1 black, 10 white, 3 black, 13 white, 2 black, and 8 white. And then that would sort of be your what you would use to get back that line of pixels. And you would get back the exact same thing, exactly like the original, so it would be lossless. And then, as I said, with lossy, you lose some data. So, like JPEGs, you guys don't need to know this, but JPEGs use this, they use these sort of templates, little square templates, where they sort of match the image to those templates and then use that to store data. I know that was very roundabout, but I talked about in the section about multimedia with the little graph. But yay! So basically, it intelligently figures out what won't be missed and sort of discards that, or dumbs it down, or you know, changes it, tosses some data out. Yay! So here are a few image formats that you guys probably should know. This is more like a reference slide than I'm gonna harp on these things. But you have JPEGs, either .jpg or .jpeg, and there's the information for that. .gif, png, and EPS. Far right side, the rightmost column, it's transparency, but you might also see it as alpha, because alpha and transparency are pretty much the same thing in different terms. So if you see alpha, it means transparency. That's all it means. I just wrote transparency up here for clarity's sake. And also, GIFs, you can do animation. So there's a GIF of Pikachu singing or talking or something. But yeah, animation, GIF, yes. Or at least image animation. Cool, so here are a few audio formats that you might want to know, or at least that was talked about. You have your standard MP3, your .AAC, which I'm not familiar with because I don't really have iTunes or Mac products. You have your .WAV, your FLAC, and .OOG. They're two different things. They're not the same file format in different spelling like the JPEGs. And you have your .MID or your .MIDI, which is pretty cool in my opinion. It makes everything sound very computerized and like, wee, electronic. Except you can't really synthesize voice, so they'll usually have they'll designate one instrument as the voice, and it'll play the notes, the musical notes for the voice. So I guess it's like your friend humming or something like that. Yay! Let's talk about video! So video is pretty much a container or a collection of files. These files are usually, you know, images and audio, or I guess the video, which is like sort of a whole bunch of images, a whole bunch of frames all put together. You might also include things like subtitles or different languages maybe. So here are a few video formats that was touched on in lecture. You have your .mov, .mp4, QuickTime, your AVI, MKV, Real Media, or Real Media. That's there twice. Guess I accidentally duplicated it. But the cool thing about MKV is I think they're really good with subtitles. So if you're watching a lot of video that's sort of translated, or in different languages. So I watch like anime, and a lot of the anime I watch is in Japanese. So when I try to, I want to incriminate myself. Never mind. Yes, anime. There's a lot of .mkv animes out there, because the anime is in Japanese, and they have English subtitles. Yay! Cool. So we have our .mkv, which is really good with subtitles. And for compressing and decompressing, you have these things called codecs. And basically, they're sort of standards or instructions on how to compress or decompress video, how to show the video, I guess. or rather how to, you know, deal with container and or the collection to show whatever you want it to show. A few examples are DIVX and this H.26264 sort of thing. So if you see those two things, just know that, oh, they're a codec, and they're used video to like compress and decompress things. And if you ever happen to have, well, if you have a Mac, then, you know, that's probably fine. But if you have a PC and you're trying to sort of watch some sort of video file and you find that maybe the sound plays but the video doesn't, that might mean that you need some sort of codec, because that happens to me fairly often. Questions? Okay, so let me give you some jargon in case you see them on the quiz, or, I mean, not the quiz, the exam. We used to call exams quizzes back in, yeah, anyway. So the aspect ratio is the ratio of width to height, so that means if you have a 4:3, it means if the width is 4 units, then the height is 3 units, and you can probably scale that up or down. And this also goes for images. If you ever see someone talking about, like, oh, that JPEG has an aspect ratio of blah, blah, blah. It also goes for that, but I've mostly seen it in terms of video. I think that's also the context that we talked about it in class. Yay. Cool. So FPS, another one of those buzzwords, I guess we want to call it that, stands for frames per second. It's pretty much the frequency that new frames or images, because remember that video is just sort of a sequence of images. So it's a frequency that those are shown. And for all those gamers out there, remember, it's not a first-person shooter. Not. Okay, not that. If you see it on the test, it's not that. Because I would totally be like, oh, I know what that is, and then, you know, oops. Dang it. And then another term that's video-related, DRM, Digital Rights Management. So they're sort of the group or the policies, or it refers to the regulation of control and access to digital data, digital media usually. It involves things like making DVDs burn-proof or encrypting like DVDs or song files so that you can't rip them onto your computer and, you know, distribute it to all your friends free of charge. So this deals with the whole sort of piracy thing, piracy versus like, you know, I actually own this thing, why can't I do what I want with what I own? So, you know, that's the whole, like, sort of debate thing going on there. Napster and Kazaa and all that was sort of involved. You know, pirates, they're involved too. Let's talk about security. Fun stuff, fun stuff. Fun and scary stuff. Cool, so let's talk about, I don't want to say arbitrarily broken security down to three things: hardware, the user, i.e. you, and others, like the server or stuff like that. But I figured maybe it'll help to, like, chunk it. So what I would call hardware security issues or security things, one main point that was really emphasized, I thought, was if someone physically has your computer, they can access your data. So that means even if you, like, did all sorts of crazy stuff, you know, encrypt it, put a whole bunch of, like, 5,000 passwords on there, if they have your computer, then, you know, you're kind of in trouble there. Cool. So what you can do is you can encrypt your data. That helps, you know. Make it such that if someone stole your computer, they'd have to work harder to sort of figure out what looks like a big mess, figure out what that means. And then if you were planning to, like, throw away your computer or give away your computer, you can protect yourself by, I guess if you're giving away your computer, you wouldn't want to, well. Anyway, if you're not using that computer anymore and you're never going to use it again, then you should probably destroy and or zero out your hard drives. That way, any data that you stored on there would be gone, you know? Any sensitive information, anything maybe you don't want people to see, you know, that'll be gone. Yay! Do you guys remember why you should do this? Like, wouldn't reformatting this computer thing, wouldn't that, like, delete all your data anyway? Don't you get the little prompt that says, warning, everything's gonna be deleted, oh no's?
That's because, like, on the table,
yeah, so that's correct. So the answer is, The answer is because formatting only deletes the file allocation table, or FAT, FAT for short. I don't really like the acronym, but guess it's memorable. It only deletes that table, and the table only stores references to where all these programs are. It doesn't actually go and like delete the program. It doesn't actually go and zero it out. Fun fact, apparently this is because back in the day computers ran kind of slow, so they figured it would take too much time and too much effort, too much cost to actually, you know, go and zero out that, you know, that deleted file. So fun fact, probably don't need to know that, but I thought it was cool. I was like, oh, so slowness of computer made this convention, and now we have to worry about this stuff. Yeah. Questions on that? On physical hardware, I guess? If not, let's go on to malware. So malware is just like the general term for malicious programs. Sometimes they're intended to be malicious, sometimes they're not, sometimes they accidentally, you know, oops, I was trying to save something and I accidentally like destroyed your hard drive. That would also be considered malware because it was malicious, but it wasn't intentional. So here's one of the things we talked about in lecture that I thought was like mentioned and sort of talked a lot about is the virus. So the main thing about this is, it's a malicious program, it's malware, but it needs the user interaction to propagate. So like say you put a virus on a flash drive, you stick it in someone else's computer, and then you stick that into like someone else's computer. It sort of needs you or like some sort of, it can't do it by itself. It needs help, I guess. And then you have the worm, which is also malware, but it's self-propagating. So like it gets on your computer and then maybe it, you know, goes through the network or something and gets on other people's computers without you doing anything. So it's sort of, I don't know, in my opinion, the worm's pretty scary because it does its own thing, kind of. And for some reason, it reminds you of, like, tapeworms and things, and that's just gross. I don't like that stuff. It's really gross. Ew. Okay, so let's talk a bit more about the worm, since it seems very dangerous and gross and ew. It turns machines into zombies, so compromised machines, well, the term is zombies, or a zombie, because, So worms, even though they infect a computer, they don't have, like they can just sort of lie in wait for a while, wait until they get enough computers around them infected to sort of make a move or to do some sort of concentrated effort. It doesn't, like, if you get infected by a worm, you might not know immediately unless, you know, your antivirus program or something, you know, picks it out. But yeah, so your machine's sort of waiting to do the bidding of this worm if it's infected. So I guess that sort of relates to zombies. Not a good thing. And if you have a whole bunch of zombies, it's called a botnet. I don't know why they called it that, but I would have called it zombie horde for all those people who play zombie games, but botnet. Okay, just some terminology in case it shows up. And then something else not quite related to malware. I guess I shouldn't have put it under that title, but there's this, I don't know what to put it under. So there's this thing called a buffer overrun. Let me explain to you what it is, and then maybe you guys can tell me where to categorize this. But, okay, no more back button. So, buffer overrun, what is this? It's, if you remember back in lecture, it's sort of where you give the user or you give whoever is interacting with it a certain amount of space to type in something or, like, insert something, and they sort of, what they give you is more than the allotted amount. So, hang on, I think I have an example here. And then if you put in more data than what you should have put in, it'll overwrite some other data, and that can either like corrupt the program, whatever you're running, or it can do other worse things. Okay, so hopefully here's my visualization. Let's say your program or whatever has this text field, and it asks for 3 characters, please, only 3. So somewhere in memory, you can sort of imagine maybe it has something like this. Like here's the allocated memory, 3. 3 for your 3 characters that it assumes that you're going to put in. And then there's like other stuff here, other instructions, you know, let's just call it do other stuff. And then let's say me being funny or something, decide to stick this in. And then I decide to click the button. So what happens if the program that this belongs to doesn't check that how much stuff I put in, then you can sort of imagine that, you know, the 3 A's go in the allotted space, and then, you know, do bad stuff will start overwriting whatever else was there. So then, you know, we can sort of imagine that do bad stuff would all do bad stuff, right? It might get executed, might, like, delete your hard drive or something. It might, I don't know, send out stuff, send out your passwords to somebody. I don't know. But so that's sort of how it works. Does that make sense? Does that help? So it's basically you're given this amount of space, and the programmer didn't check to make sure the user's input actually like doesn't go beyond that space. And then it just sort of sticks it in, and then it like overwrites things. And then bad stuff happens. You'll be lucky if the program just crashes, because then that means like, oh, cool, it noticed something weird was going on, and then it stopped, as opposed to like, oh, I'm going to go execute some carefully crafted code that's really bad. Yay? Questions on this? Sure.
So would you say like a virus is worse than the worm?
Well, I would say the worm, in my opinion, would be worse than the virus because it can like propagate itself. So you like you could just leave your computer on and it could be like it could like go infect other machines or something like that. So in my opinion, that would be worse because at least with the virus, I would know that I sort of had something to do with it. I or someone, maybe my friend. I don't know. But in my opinion, the worm would be worse. But yay, buffer overrun, yay, nay. The solution to this would just be to check your input, the programmer, the program to check to make sure that input was actually like three characters or whatever. So it's not too hard of a solution, but you know, sometimes programmers get kind of, well, I know I get kind of lazy and I don't really check everything I should check. And then bad stuff happens. Don't be like me. That's bad. Cool, so let's move on to my random, well not really random, my category of user, because I'm not quite sure what else to call it. But let's talk about authentication. Say you're on the web, you're browsing around, or maybe you just have your computer, and you're trying to log in. Your computer wants to make sure it's you that's trying to log in, not like your friend or your worst enemy, or something like that. The first sort of form of authentication, I guess if you want to call it that, would be passwords. Yay, I don't want to like drill this in again and again, but a few tips that were shown in lecture. Don't keep all your passwords in one place. You know, don't stick them in like a text file and stick it on your desktop or even like try to hide it on your computer somewhere. You know, someone will probably find it and then bad things will happen. Don't put it on sticky and stick it on your monitor. That's even sort of worse because then someone passing by could just be like, oh, cool, what's that? So that'd be bad. And then having different ones for different websites would be good since say one of them gets hacked or someone finds out about one of your passwords, they wouldn't have access to everything else that you log into. So, you know, just some tips, you know, make passwords hard to guess. Don't have it be like cat. Not that most sites would let you do that these days. But, you know, make them hard to guess. Use variations of English words or something like that. Or, you know, because the first thing a hacker who's trying to get your password might try to do would be try every single word in the dictionary or something. So, you know, make it hard. Make them work for it. And then hopefully they don't ever get there. Okay, so in case passwords aren't enough, because sometimes they're not, for things like your banking account, that's pretty, you know, that's pretty private stuff. That's pretty, you know, that'd be pretty bad if someone hacked into that. So they have this thing called two-factor authentication, which means that in addition to like your username and your password, you have this additional way of proving that you are you and you're not like some hacker trying to break in who got your password or something like that. So a few examples of this is like when you try to log in or something, you'll get sent a secret code or something, or a secret message or something via text, i.e. your phone. The assumption is that you own your phone and you have it right now. So that proves that you are you because you have your phone. Or some sort of physical token, like I think Dan showed us his little like bank thingy. I don't know what you call that, but it every 10 seconds or something, it randomly generates a string of characters that you would need to know or have to access your bank account with that company. And then something else would be sort of like sending you an email, because this presumably only you have access to your email, hopefully. So that'll sort of prove additionally that you are you and you're not like me who stole your password. Not that I would do that, but in case. Questions on that? Authentication? Password? Login? Let's not share any passwords. That'd be kind of not cool. Okay, so let's talk about, okay, so you're logged into, I don't know, your computer or you're logged into a website. Let's start surfing. What bad things can happen? Well, there's phishing, PH, not with an F, but I guess maybe that's where it came from. My definition would be sort of someone seeking personal information from you that you probably don't want to give away, i.e. your passwords, maybe your PIN, your social security number, you know, things that should be private to you. So trying to get your information without sort of your consent. And how they do this is they usually sort of imitate something that looks official. They sort of capitalize on human behaviors, sort of like unawareness or laziness. Like, I'm sure not everyone, I mean, I don't even do this, check like the URL every time they click a link. Maybe their URL sort of takes you somewhere else that looks like it could be official but isn't, like bankof.america.com or something. That's, you know, not good. So phishing. And then there is session hijacking. So this is, in a nutshell, it'd be someone impersonating you through cookies. So if you'll recall that HTTP packets, okay, first off, cookies are just sort of a really long string of characters or text that the server places on your computer and that your computer can like send back to the server to let it know that, hey, you know, I'm logged in, hey, this is me, hey, remember me, sort of, that's pretty much what a cookie is. And then these cookies are sent back and forth through HTTP packets, right? Because you're surfing the internet, that's how you communicate with the server. And recall that HTTP packets are pretty much freely sniffable. If you know the right configurations, if you have the right program, i.e. FireSheep. And then let's say, you know, you're sending out all these packets and some of them have cookies. Let's say someone grabs one of your cookies, looks at the, you know, looks at the text, whatever, text line of text, and then they decided to, you know, use the same line of text to access the same website. Oh no, that website now thinks that the bad person is you, and now they can do everything that you can do, without logging in, without having to log in, without having all that stuff. Isn't that scary? That's, yeah, not cool. Way worse than someone logging into your Facebook and, like, posting random stuff on your wall. Cool, so how do you combat this scary, scary thing? Well, okay, for phishing, be aware, be skeptical. If it sounds too good to be true, maybe it is. I guess if you want to be paranoid, you can like check the URL and check and make sure whatever links you're clicking actually goes where you think it goes. And as for the second scary thing, you can do HTTPS, or which stands for HTTP Secure. It's a combination of HTTP protocol, which you know allows you to communicate with servers and things, as well as with SSL, so that sort of encrypts your stuff, encrypts your cookies and things, so that someone who just sees it as is wouldn't be able to, you know, imitate it or go and be you, I guess. Yay! So yeah, it encrypts your requests. Yay! Yes?
If you're the victim of a session hijack, will you no longer still be logged in? Like, is it dependent on the site? Like,
well,
if somebody else is. If it's going through another IP, or if you log out, when you actually log out, and log out for the other person as well.
Okay, so the question was, what happens if you do get this, your session hijacked? Like, what happens then? Do you get logged out? What happens if you log out? Does the other person get logged out? I'm pretty sure it has to do with how the site deals with this, because I know what are some sites, if you're logged in two places, say two different computers, and you log out in one computer, like both the account will be logged out of everywhere. But I do know that, because I've sort of tried messing around with FireSheep just for fun, but I know that if you session hijack someone else, like they'll pretty much have no clue and you can do whatever you want and they can do whatever you want. And then as for logging out, I think that might depend on the website. So yeah, you could be like hijacked and you wouldn't even know it until you find yourself posting incriminating messages on your wall or something. I don't know. It's pretty scary. But luckily, Facebook, I hear, has implemented HTTPS for all of their pages, which is good. Now you can't, like, post on someone else's wall as themselves. And then, so yeah, your requests are encrypted. Even though people can grab that packet or whatever and look at it, they can't decrypt it, which is, yay, awesome. They can't impersonate you anymore. And, of course, this is not fail-safe. It just reduces the risk, because somewhere along the way, maybe you're sending your data to some server that's far away and it makes many hops. If any one of those hops sort of don't encrypt your stuff, then, you know, oops, whoever's there could probably get it. But it does sort of reduce the whole, you know, if you're sitting in an internet cafe with a high density of, like, people all around you, it sort of reduces the risk at that step. So it's not fail-safe, but just know that it's out there. And you can use things like HTTPS everywhere and make everything secure, I guess. But that might make your requests a bit slower because you have to encrypt them all and send them out and decrypt and all that. Yeah, any questions on this? Question? Nope. Yeah, so if you were session hijacked, you would have no clue that it was happening until you saw something weird, like you saw that you posted on your own wall saying something weird, and you were like, I did not do that. So you would have, you wouldn't know.
And as far as the cookie shows up on the screen, or
Do you see that cookie there? Well, so cookies are just sort of text files stored on your computer. So like right now, you can like go on your computer. Oh no, because it's like buried in I think some of the system folders or something like that. Like I was gonna show, maybe I'll show you later. But the cookies are from the server and they're actually put on your computer somewhere hidden deep in like program files. And when you're requesting something with a site that has that you have a cookie for, you actually send that cookie along. So if you have the program or if you reconfigure your laptop or whatever, you can actually see like the cookie. So I can like demo that like at the end if you want to see that. Or I can show you all my cookies, which, I don't know, hopefully I haven't been anywhere weird. Yay! Okay, so let's talk about other factors or other things besides like you and your hardware. So first off, let's talk about the server. What things can go wrong here? Well, there's the SQL injection attack. What the heck is that? You can think of it as someone inserting malicious code that gets executed. So it's sort of like buffer overrun, but not quite. Buffer overrun had more to do with the space that you were given versus here someone's actually like inserting, someone anticipates that a certain statement is going to get executed and sort of alters that statement. So this mainly, they mess with your databases. Here's an example that some of you may have seen before. It's from XKCD, which nerdy geek comic. So what's going on here is apparently the mom named, I'm too short to like point. This is sad. Okay. So apparently the mom named her son this entire thing right here, minus the question mark, Robert, end quote, open or close parenthesis, semicolon, drop table students. So she's sort of making an assumption that the school calls their database of students, students. And she also assumed that they're going to put his name into the database. Well, I guess you kind of have to do that if you're a student. And then, of course, once they put this entire thing in, as you can sort of see here, the implication is that they put in the name Robert, and then it continues on to execute this drop table students thing. And oops, there goes the entire table. So it's anticipating what command might be executed with what sort of input what sort of input they want from you, and then you sort of manipulate that to do bad things. So I think the example Dan showed is that you could actually, without knowing someone's password, you can sort of make it so that you can log in as them. If you do, I'll let you look at that. If you do this little bit of code that Dan sort of showed you. Which is kind of cool, but of course the servers can protect against this by installing some stuff or setting some of the settings, or you, the programmer, or if you program, there's a very easy function or easy little command that you can do before you insert or do anything with their databases that, will solve this problem. It's just, some people are kind of lazy, like me, or they're just unaware, which I used to be, but yeah. So this isn't like, oh no, end of world, but it still happens sometimes. Cool, so another kind of attack is man in the middle. So I think I have a graphic here, graphic quote unquote, but let's talk about this a little bit first. It's, in a nutshell, it's where there's a third entity. So say you're trying to communicate with your friend Bob or Alice or something like that, and there's this third entity that you're unaware of that intercepts the request and sort of acts as the person in the middle who, sends and receives. And this, usually the two parties, the other two parties, aren't aware of this. So here's a little graphic. Say you have this cube, his name will be Cube because he's a cube, who wants to talk to this companion cube, so I'm going to call it CC, because companion cube is kind of long. So let's say the cube says, hey CC, it's Cube, can I have your key, because I want to send you some secret information about upcoming games or something like that, something really cool, about portal guns that are being developed. Top secret, right? Okay, so it's, you know, it sends it, and then, oh noes, an evil third party comes in and intercepts that. You know, before it gets to CC over here, this third party, let's call him the turret, intercepts it, and now he's going to be like, hee hee hee, now I'm gonna make CC think that that this is coming from Cube. So I'm just sort of going to pass along the message. You know, no harm done thus far yet. So he sort of talks to CC and says, no, hey, you know, it's Cube. Can I have your key? CC is oblivious. So sure, here's my key. And then he takes it. He memorizes it or whatever. And then he sends off, you know, the same message. Sure. And he sends his own key. Oh, no. Now he has, like, access to the messages coming in from both sides. So does this go on more? Okay, so now that the turret has the key from both sides, he can, well, you can probably imagine what he can do. Like, their communication is no longer secure. If he wanted to, he could probably send requests that seem to be coming from Cube, but aren't actually. So yeah, bad stuff happens. Ah, turret is evil. Look at that evil face. Evil but happy, I guess. So that's sort of a visual of how man-in-the-middle attacks kind of work. In case you know you were confused or didn't quite catch it in lecture or something like that. So these characters are from Portal. Portal 2. You know, the same characters. Portal 2 was out earlier this week, guys. It's so awesome. I finished it. And okay, anyway, rant. 3 hours later. Back to this. Yes. Turret evil. Cool. So I've been talking a lot about encrypting things and encryption and, you know, cryptography. Well, okay, so the practice of encryption is cryptography. But I figured I should dedicate a slide to this. You know, just to review. Go over a bit. Okay, not the back button. Cool. So there are a few ciphers or a few methods of encrypting things. Some very basic, I guess, ciphers would be, that we talked about, would be CSER, where you just pretty much rotate every letter of your message by a fixed number. So like if your number was 1, every letter A would become the letter B, B would become C, Z would wrap back around to A. So it's sort of like a little childish little kids, at least this is what I did to encrypt things when I was a little kid. I'd be like, oh, we're going to rotate it by like 13. Rot 13. If you hear that, rot 13 just means that it's CSER cipher with rotating each letter 13 spots in the alphabet. If you go past Z, you just wrap back around to A. That's CSER. Visionaire is a bit more complex. Instead of using the same number of rotations for each letter, you're going to use a keyword, and from that keyword, from each character of the keyword, that's where you're going to get your number of rotations. So, of course, each character of the keyword stands for number. So A stands for 0, B stands for 1, C stands for 2, and then so forth. So you pretty much use a keyword, which can change. You know, it's not like a fixed number like Rot13 or whatever. And according to each of those characters, that's what you would rotate. Yay, nay. I can show you like this interesting graphic. Maybe it's interesting, I don't know. Show you a demo of how you'd go about encrypting something in another slide at the end if you want to see this in action. Cool. So CSER and Visionaire, they're kind of rudimentary, right? They're not too safe if someone really wants your information and is just gonna like try every single possible combination or something like that. So there's this other thing called private key cryptography. So this is two-way. I don't think it's too hard of a concept. Basically, Cube wants to talk to CC, they share a private key, and they just use that one key to talk to each other. The bad part about this is, what if somebody randomly comes in and gets that private key? Oh no, now they can't really, they're not like, it's not exclusive to those two anymore. So I mean, that's better. better than, say, Caesar or Visionaire. But there's still, it's still a bit problematic. So there's this other thing called public key, which is one way, quote unquote. I'll tell you why in a little bit. I think I have comic, maybe? Oh. Okay, so first off, a bit of data. So say you want to send something to person B. What you would do is you would encrypt whatever you want to send with B's public key, which like anyone can have, like he can give it out to anybody. It's fine if people know it. And then when B receives it, so after you encrypt it with the public key, the only way to decrypt it would be with the private key, which no one else has except, that person, so B in this case. So let's have our friend Cube and CC again to demonstrate. So let's say Cube sends CC a message, oh, hi, and he uses CC's public key and gets out this weird-looking thing or something like that. This is just, for demo purposes. And then once CC has it, she uses her private key on that encrypted message and gets out, oh, hi, yay, the original message. And then, as you can sort of see, this is one way because CC can't really encrypt it with her public key and send it back because you'd need the private key to decrypt it, which only she has. So if you want it to be two-way, quote-unquote, you'd sort of have to know, CC would have to know Cube's public key, and then, sort of mirrored of that. Then when Cube gets the encrypted message, Cube would have to use his own private key to decrypt. So two different keys for encrypting and decrypting. Does that seem safer to you guys? Because no one else has this private key, and the public key can only encrypt, it cannot decrypt. So if you encrypt something, like, no one else is going to be able to read it unless they have that private key, which only that person has. Yay, nay, maybe need to sync in a bit. So if you want two-way, you sort of need to know, both of you need to know each other's public keys, and then you each have your own private key to decrypt whatever encrypted message that you were sent. You guys can do it! Well, I guess I'll let it sink in unless you guys have questions. Or if you guys want to vote for who's cooler, Cube or CC. I already know what I'm voting for, but him. I won't let you guys, I'm not going to sway you guys. Wait, did I press the back button? Yay! Questions about security in general? How we can hack into other people? Never mind. I'm not going to tell you that. Maybe. Well, no. I'm not going to show you my phishing demo either, because that's... anyway. No questions. Okay, let's go on to website development. So here's sort of a loose roadmap, I guess we want to call it. Call it that. HTML and CSS and then a bit of Scratch. HTML. You probably don't need to know this, but it stands for Hypertext Markup Language. Notice markup language. So it's not a programming language. It's a markup language. What do I mean by that? Well, I'll talk a little bit more about programming in the next section. But markup, in a nutshell, generally you can think of it as just making things look pretty, the aesthetics. There's no really like logic. You can't be like, if today is Tuesday, or if today is April 19th, show the portal logo. You can't do something like that. You make text different colors, different sizes. That's the general idea of a markup language, aesthetics. So the basic building blocks of web pages is written in HTML. HTML elements are tags, and there are these things that are enclosed within these angle brackets. So like B tag, U tag, I tag, IMG tag. And they're usually, not always, paired. So usually if you want to apply formatting to a section of text, you'd open the tag, have your text in the middle, and then close the tag. But there are other tags, like image tags, which doesn't really make sense to put something in the middle, because you either have an image, you can't put text in the middle of your image. So they're usually paired, but not always. And some of the tags can also have attributes, another keyword, jargon word, whatever you want to call it, for more tag information. So I'll show you examples in a bit. But question time! We haven't had this in a long while. So let's assume that what you see is the only thing that's there. What's wrong with this? Why is this not valid HTML? Let's just assume that that's all there is. Like, there's no, like, close tags or whatever. Why is this wrong? Yeah. Besides, yeah? Okay, so, yeah.
Where do you want to start?
Yeah, I guess you could, like, head up here. But, so if we just assume that this is all he has, it would be problematic because he doesn't sort of define what document this is. He doesn't tell us this is HTML or what version of HTML. He also doesn't have an open head tag, so, like, why is he closing this head tag? And if he doesn't have a closed body tag, then that's also, you know, not... that's, like, wrong. That's not right if you want to create, like, a web page. But, yes, I'll address the title thing in the next slide. So let's give you an example and sort of point out certain bits and pieces of HTML document. So you have this first line, this doc type HTML. HTML should probably be lowercase. Oops, I forgot to change this. But atop every HTML-like page you write, you need that. Why? Because it's a convention. It tells the browser that, you know, it tells you, hey, this document type is HTML. And then after that, to sort of open your document, you need these open and close HTML tags, and it sort of defines the document. So one tells your browser, the other one defines, like, the document. Here's the document. It's all the stuff inside. And then every HTML web page has head and body later, which I will talk about. But head and body. So in the head is where all your sort of... Wait, did that work? So it's pretty much the information about that document. So here you might put things like meta information, things that if a search bot or a crawler goes across your page, what they can categorize your page as, or you know what search terms you want associated with your page, things like that. But you can also have title tags. I think that's going to highlight next. I don't think you necessarily need title tags. And then I guess it'll just be blank or it'll say something default up there. But the title tag pretty much puts the text within those tags, I guess in the title bar. Does that make sense? Like when you open up a browser, you have that very space at the top. And it says something like, I don't know, Harvard website or something like that. So it's just the title for that window, I guess, or that tab. Like, you wouldn't see it actually on, like, the page. You'll see it on the top of that. Wait, so, yep, defines page style. And then you have your body, which every HTML page needs. This will be everything that will get displayed on, like, the screen. So here, all I have is just welcome bolded. So it bolds formatting. Hey, look at this. It looks like a demo. Let's click it. So here's the title, like this, a random web page. It goes right here. And then, well, all I have was welcome in bold. So here's welcome in bold. Yay! Wasn't that awesome? You guys can make this yourselves. Stick it in a notepad thing. Save it as a .html instead of .txt. And voila, you have your web page. Albeit a bit, you know, a bit empty. Spacious, I guess, is the term. But yay! Questions about this anatomy example of HTML tags and things? Okay, cool. So here's, I guess, more a study guide than me lecturing. But here are a few possibly helpful HTML tags to remember or to know or whatever that I think is important. Head and body. You always need open, close. And for any HTML document, you need those two. And you should probably not have anything in between the close head and open body, because that's sort of like no man's land. Like, that's not part of the page's description, and it's also not part of what you're going to display. So that's kind of, no, probably shouldn't do that. And then there are these formatting, like easy formatting tags, B for bold, I for italics, U for underline. Make sure you close them, otherwise it'll make everything else, you know, in the same format. So I've totally done things where I've opened a B tag and then forgot to close it, and then I view my web page and everything is bolded and not very cool looking. So open and close, cool. Okay, not clicking back. For links, they look something sort of like this. You have A, the tag, for anchor, And href is the, I think, hypertext reference. And then you have your URL. So you're just saying, hey, this is the URL I want to sort of link to, anchor to, I guess you want to call it that. And this is the text that will get hyperlinked, some text. And then do make sure you close it. Otherwise, everything else would be hyperlinked to that one link. Probably a bad thing. But so that's sort of what it looks like. Href would be, I think, an attribute of the anchor tag. And then for images, easier to see the attribute, image source. You know, once again, your URL of your image. And alt is, conventionally, you should always have this. And it displays in case the image is missing or in case something goes wrong with the image, at least the person viewing it or the person crawling the web, you know, not actually seeing images, but just seeing text, would know what should have been there. So if you were crawling, it's also for those who are visually impaired, because I'm assuming they have something that sort of crawls the page and sort of dictates or tells them what it is, and they can't really see the image, so they'll get the alt instead. So something useful should go there, like instead of apic, maybe cute doggy or something like that, if this is an image of a dog. But some web browsers, I think it's only IE now, that they'll actually, if you mouse over the image, they'll show the alt text. But that's not every browser. Like, I don't think that's standard convention of what it's supposed to do. But a lot of web browsers used to do that. Not all of them do anymore, which is kind of sad in my opinion, but just my opinion. So here we have the image tag. That's a tag. And then we have src, which is the attribute. Alt is also an attribute because it sort of modifies or adds to the image tag. And then we have sort of the values and things for those attributes. Just some more jargon. So if we're asking you some weird question about attributes and tags, you'll know what is what. So tables, a bit more complicated. So let's say, how you would start a table or denote that, hey, this is going to be a table, is with the table tag and the close table tag, and everything inside will be part of the table. TR tags are what's enclosed between the open and closed TR tags is one row. And then, as you can sort of guess, TD, what's enclosed within that is a column inside that row that it's enclosed within. So visually, this looks like this, 2x2. Because we have two rows here, because we have two sets of these tags, TR tags. And then within each of those, we have two sets of these TD tags. So that makes it 2x2. Can you guys tell me where the winky face goes? Like, let's number them like 1, 2, 3, 4. Where does the winky face come from? Or go to, rather. I guess you could just like, pardon?
Top left.
Top left. Okay, so top left.
Left.
Yes. The winky face goes there. So then happy face should, shouldn't be too hard to figure out where that goes. Right, next column over. Happy face, yeah. What about the crying face? Crying face, where does that go? Let's get the winky crying face with the tears. Or the one tear, I guess. Where's that go? Where's this unhappy face go?
Three.
Yes! Three, or that slot. And process of elimination, protesting face or screaming face or whatever you want to call that face, emoticon, goes there. So yeah, that's how it looks visually. If you're asked to make a table, if you want to know how to make a table, that's how you would do it. You can definitely put more TR tags, more TD tags. You can even put a table inside a table. It's some pretty weird stuff, but actually, no, it works out pretty well. You can totally do that, too, if you want to. But make sure all of your tags open and close at the right moments and or right positions and all that. Yay! You guys are masters at tables now. You can, like, make your own table, and if you get asked a table with, like, confusing questions, and hopefully you guys will be able to, like, tease out what it looks like. And if you just stuck this into a web page, you actually wouldn't see the borders here because you'd have to specify that you want the borders shown. So I just have the borders here to like show you guys, educationally. But on a web page, you wouldn't see the borders unless you specified with like the style attribute or some other deprecated HTML code that you want the borders shown. I guess they should be gray, but I guess it didn't show up too well on the screen. Questions on these tags? Okay. Familiar, super cool with these tags. Best buddies. Gonna go hang out tonight, maybe? I don't know. So, here's a few more HTML tags that I sort of forgot to animate this slide with, but anyway. So, some pretty powerful tags. I'm gonna just call them separators, because they sort of divide up the page into either a chunk or block, or like an entire division. These are shown as the div tags and the span tags. And the cool thing about these is you can put in the style attribute, and then you can like format everything that goes within those tags. So say you had div tag, create a division. You can have other attributes like div name equals blah or whatever and select it later. But you can do like div style and then color equals blue. So everything between these two double quotes is CSS. And you need the double quotes, otherwise it's going to be like, what are you trying to do? Like, what's going on? But everything between those double quotes for the style attribute is CSS. So someone, whenever they created CSS, decided that if you just write color, it's going to refer to the font color. I don't know why. That's kind of weird, in my opinion, since background color is like background-color. Why is font color, not font.-color? I don't know. So if I had this line of code right here, it would just show portal 2 exclamation point in blue. Yay, blue. Well, I guess it could be any color, but blue, meh. And then if I have this span tag down here with the attribute style and color, font color, orange, and font weight. So that's what they should have done, font color, right? It makes sense. Font weight bold. And if you stuck this in, you'll see that two awesome exclamation point would be in orange and bolded. And this everything inside these double quotes is CSS. That's why it looks kind of different. It has like colons instead of equal signs. It has like dashes and things like that. So yay! CSS with style.
Yeah, the portal 2, is that CSS also?
No. So the question was where does the CSS end and start, and is portal 2 up there part of CSS? So where's my mouse? Okay, just to reiterate, everything within the double quotes. So this quote and this quote, everything within that is CSS. Everything else is still, you know, HTML or a text or whatever it was before. So portal 2 here is just text that I want to display because it's not inside any of the tags. It's not a tag itself, and this closed div is still like a closed tag to conform with HTML standards and all that. So the difference between div and span, just to reiterate, is for div, you actually make division of the page. So it's the it's like as if you drew a line, a horizontal line across the page, and you have this like block, this chunk, this division, I guess. And span only goes until the end of, until wherever you put the closed span tag. So here it would have two awesome exclamation point, and then it would end there, versus for the div up here, it would take that entire line that portal 2 is on. So that's why I think David mentioned that if you do div, whenever you close a div tag, it'll sort of automatically incorporate a paragraph break, not paragraph, sorry, line break. So if you wanted to do different styles of things on the same line, you would have to use span. Does that make any sense? That's when David did the whole like, was it like hello world with like hello in a different format or style, and then world was like really small or something like that. So yeah, if you're asked about the difference between div and span, that's it. Div creates like that, you know, division, and then span just goes to your closed span tag. Yay! So remember, double quotes, inside those double quotes, CSS. That's why it looks so weird, but yes. Questions on this? Gonna go out and make super cool web pages with random formatting. Well, not random, but. Okay, so let's move on and talk about CSS. What is CSS? It is, well, it's not that, unfortunately. I'm really bad at that, so. So Counter-Strike Source is, for those who game, it's a game that has very intense people, and that's why I'm not very good at it, because you're either a terrorist or a counter-terrorist, and you like shoot each other and try to kill each other. That's, you know, in a nutshell. So it's actually cascading style sheets, or sheet, I guess, if you only have one. What is it? why does it matter? It's a way to factor out common formatting. So let's say you want your entire everything inside your body tags to be like green or something. Then you can sort of factor that out and just write one line. Or if you want a certain, say you want every div tag to be bolded, everything within any div tag to be bolded, then you can sort of factor that out instead of sticking style in every single one of your div tags and telling it to be bold. So it's a pretty cool way of factoring things out. That leads to neater organization and also centralized because everything got factored out to a separate file or something. Easier to change. You can change one instance of it as opposed to like 5,000 if you have 5,000 of those formatting things. And it separates content from presentation. So content is like whatever you want to show on your web page, like say Portal 2 or some essay that you wrote. Presentation would be like, oh, this looks pretty, make it bold or make it the background green or something like that. That's what I mean by presentation versus content. So aesthetics versus, the information you want to throw up on your web page. And what you can do with CSS is pretty cool because you can apply formatting specific to certain tags or certain portions of your page, to certain page elements. And it does this using things called selectors, just some jargon so I can explain to you guys what CSS is and how it does things. And there are three ways to include CSS or to embed it in your page. So one way we've already seen is the style attribute. This doesn't quite factor things out so much as the other two types, because everywhere you have a div tag or span tag, you'll have to write that style attribute and then stick that CSS in there. But you can also stick all of your CSS up in within the head tags with a bit of bit more coding. But you can stick all your CSS up there. And you can also stick it in a separate CSS file and link that file in the head of the HTML file that you want to use the CSS file with. Cool, so let's talk about CSS and outside of the style tag, how does it look, what's it look like, how do you do this? So there are these things called selector, which the term's kind of, I hope, suggestive, that it selects something and applies that formatting to whatever it selected. So here we have body, which is the selector, where you can apply the following format, and it can also be made up, so it could be like, oh, hi, and then like random formatting, and then everywhere it sees that, tag, it'll apply that formatting. So here it's going to look for the body tag and everything inside the body tags. It'll apply what's called declarations, some jargon that you might not need to know, or the formatting. So here, for your entire body, it's going to make the background black, and it's going to make the font color white. So a bit more jargon, properties and values. Properties and values. So if, you're asked, what properties does the Ohi selector have? Then, you'll know it's background and color and not like black and white or something like that. And so I guess this is not a very cool example, but if I change this to say B, for bold, then everywhere it sees the B tag, it'll also apply this stuff in here. So you can sort of see how or why it's called a selector, because it selects certain tags to apply this formatting to there. And if you take a more advanced sort of web programming course or web development course, you'll know that, or you can watch my section, I have other types of selectors. This is the basic selector. You can have specific selectors where you actually select for the tag and its name or its ID or its class. So you can, I think David sort of showed this, but you can, so you had a div tag with an attribute, class equals center or class equals oh hi or whatever. You can actually select for that specific div tags with this class. So if the div tag doesn't have that class, it won't get selected. So you can do pretty cool selecting tags with these selectors in CSS. If you guys want to go and research that, or just watch my section because I sort of lay out two other types of selectors. But yeah, it's really cool. Finds it on your page and then applies it between the tags. Questions on CSS? Blank stares? Okay, I guess we can move on to... Okay, big grin, nice. Let's go on to programming. I love this stuff. Yeah, see, there we go. I included Scratch. I guess I sort of forgot to include that before on my little agenda page, but it's there now. So let's talk about programming. What is programming? Okay, so I thought about this long and hard because I guess I'm really used to programming and it gets hard to define things that you're really familiar with, maybe. So generally, it's writing a set of instructions to be executed, to get executed, to do some sort of task. Or I guess it doesn't actually have to do anything, but then that would be kind of useless or trivial. And it involves logic. So you can have conditions. You can have, check if today is Tuesday. And if it is Tuesday, then, I don't know, play cool music or something like that. Or see if today is weekend. And if it is the weekend, go party or something. I don't know. So I'm going to call this decision making because you sort of take a certain path or you do a certain thing because of some sort of input or some sort of check that you do. And generally, it's more dynamic than, say, a markup language where you just make things pretty, generalizing here. With programming, you can actually make it do things, quotation marks, do things. Hopefully, my examples will be more enlightening than, this. But, yay! So in programming, there are certain constructs that are sort of, even though there are a lot of, different programming languages, there are certain things that more or less stay the same-ish among the languages, or among a number of the languages. So there's logic. And in subclass of logic, you have these things called conditions, and they're used to make sort of decisions, to decide whether you want to take, this branch of the program or this other branch to sort of direct control flow, if you guys like that jargon. I don't think you need to know that. But so there are conditions. These are things like if expression or condition is true, then execute this chunk of code that follows the then. And then else, i.e. if the condition or expression is not true, then execute this other chunk of code. So you take either one of the two paths. And you can sort of think about nesting these if expressions together to make multiple paths along whatever you're trying to make. So, if else, if then else, if you want to call it that, it sort of allows you to make a decision between two choices or several choices depending on this expression or condition. Okay, so to make these expressions or conditions, you have these things called Booleans. So they're used to make more precise conditions because you can do something like if today is Tuesday, do whatever. Or you can do if today is Tuesday and it's raining, bring an umbrella or something like that. I don't know why Tuesday has anything to do with that, but okay. So a few Booleans are the and. So if both of these expressions are true, then the whole thing is true. Yay, nay, because this has to be true and that has to be true. So if today is Tuesday and it is raining. If it's just Tuesday and it's not raining, then that's not going to be true. You have your or. So if either of the two or both is true, then it is true. Same goes for false. Yes, or. If expression one is true, then the whole thing is already true. If expression one is false, but expression two is true, then the whole thing is also true. And if they're both true, then they're both true. The only time it's false is if both are false. Does that make sense? Yay, nay. Okay, one more, not. So this one only takes one expression. It is the opposite of that expression. So if expression one is true, not expression one is the opposite of that, false, and vice versa. So this sort of helps you make better expressions, better conditions for your if-then-else sort of thing. And then you also have loops. And this is, used to repeat. You can combine these with conditions. So you can have, while this condition is true, maybe it has a few Booleans in there, then you execute this chunk of code over and over again until the condition is false. So while continuously, more or less, continuously checks the condition, and so long as it is true, it'll keep executing this over and over again. So it loops around, if you want to think about that. I guess in Scratch you have this forever loop, which, you could probably make it out of a while loop or something like that, which, loops forever until you, close the program or something like that, or stop your Scratch project from running. Yay, loops. There's other types of loops if you take programming languages, but while I think is the essential one. There's also for, but I'm not going to go into that. Questions on this, programming constructs? Yay, other questions? Go off and program some cool stuff? Well, I guess that'll be in Scratch, but that's still cool. Okay, so let's talk about this thing called pseudocode, because I think it's an important part of programming, and David did talk about it. In fact, I think he started out his lecture with pseudocode, and I didn't really cover this in section, so I'm going to do it now. So pseudocode, generally is you're going to use English and the notion of the constructs, you know, the ifs, elses, while, and whatever, to sort of plan or outline your code. So you're not coding because you're not writing in some sort of valid language that you can go and, you know, compile and execute it. You're just sort of, to relate it to, if you were writing an essay, you'd make a brainstorm and write some like cloud things or whatever. This is sort of like that. It's sort of like code in English that is general enough that any sort of programmer would, and any sort of person could sort of tease out what's going on. So, and also there's no strict rules really, like whether or not you put parentheses or not, or if you'd put like a colon or something like that. That's, you know, not really, there's not really strict rules. Indentation, though, should be, you know. Okay. Yay, so example. Examples are always best. So David had this, like, socks on feet sort of thing. I have this one and guesses thing. What does this do, guys? And again, Portal 2 themed because, yeah. Anyway. So do you guys know what this does? Yay, nay, sort of. Yeah, but what, okay, so why don't we walk through this? So here it looks like I'm setting 1 to false, so some sort of variable called 1. So like you can have x, you know, in math you have x, y, whatever. I'm going to call it 1 just so I know what it is. And apparently I have another variable here called guesses, starts off at 0. I guess no guesses have been made, maybe. And I have this loop here, while 1 not equals true. Well, it starts out as false, and it hasn't changed yet. So it's going to execute all this indented stuff in here. Or this is the ground where it'll execute next. So here it waits for input. So let's assume it gets input at some point, and it's going to check that input. If input is portal 2, notice that that's a true or false condition, you know. If it is Portal 2, that's true. If it's not, maybe the user typed in like Half-Life 2 or Half-Life 3 or something like that. That'll be false. So if this is true, if the user inputted Portal 2, we're going to display, you got it, and then change 1 to be true. And then after that, it'll increment guesses. And when it checks while again, after it like loops back around from here, it loops back up here. Now 1 is true, it'll break out and have cake. I want some cake. Meh. But, okay, let's go back to our branch, our if branch here. If the user did not type in portal 2, it's not going to execute this, because this is only if that condition is true. It's going to jump to the else and print, nope, sorry, and continue on, which is, you know, increment guesses. And then it's going to loop back around, 1 is still false, and it's going to go and do it again. Okay, so few things to note would be exclamation point or bang means not. So while 1 bang equals true, not equals true. And variables can be used to store state. So here I use 1 to sort of store whether the user has correctly guessed or not. So that can break out of the loop. So yay, variable state. Or you can have variables to keep track of something like the number of guesses the user has taken, which is what guesses is. So indentation, in my opinion, is important. It's, when you're coding, the compiler usually doesn't care about white space, but it's really helpful to the reader and or the programmer, when they're trying to read or interpret this code. So just to show you, the entire program is that, or entire program as I've shown it. And then the while loop only executes that bit in the lighter blue. That's, so the while loop never ever goes outside of that range there. And the if true, then it executes that bit in green. And if it's false, that condition is false, it only executes that, and then it goes out one layer, increments guesses, and so forth. So do you guys sort of see how the control flow or how the program gets directed into these little indentation things? No? Yeah, yeah. Well, I can show you more examples after the slides, and we can figure this out. But yay, if you see some sort of pseudocode, hopefully you'll be able to tease apart what it does. Speaking of which, what's this do? And I've intentionally put space in there so you guys can fill it in. Like, it's not going to print spaces. What does this do? Oh, I should have numbered the lines. Oh, well, too late. It's a little bit tricky, I'll admit that, because I already showed you the other pseudocode bit that could have been trickier, but. Okay, so you guys look kind of confused. Let's go through this line by line. Loop forever, everything that's been indented over one, so it's going to keep on doing this forever, until you like stop the program or something like that. And first it's going to go I equals, so that's probably going to be a variable because it's not in a condition or a while loop or while statement or anything. So we're going to assign I, what are we going to assign it? We're going to prompt for integer. So you can sort of imagine that the computer is going to be like, hey dude, give me an integer, and once I get that integer, I'm going to stick it in the variable I. So I will contain the integer that the user gave. And here we have an if. We know what that does, right? If whatever's inside is true, execute this, otherwise execute that. So we call something remainder of I divided by 2. So if I is the integer the user gave us, let's divide it by 2 and find the remainder of that. And then check to see if the remainder equals 0. If that is true, then we're going to print something here, which I didn't fill in for you guys. And if otherwise, we're going to print something else. Do you guys sort of see what it's doing? So if I give it, say, 6, I becomes 6. We're going to do 6 divided by 2, 3. And the remainder of that division was 0, right? Because it divides cleanly into those numbers. Then we're going to print this. Yay, nay, a bit of math, even though I claim that I don't like math at all. Well, I mean, yeah, I guess we're kind of buddies, whatever. Okay, so I'll give it to you. All this does is it tells you whether a number is even or odd. What happens if we put in 0? Get 0. Okay, it classifies 0 as even. I don't know if you guys agree with that, but yeah. I'd say this is one of the trickier things because it's sort of like it's using a variable and doing stuff to it and then doing other stuff to it before it checks the condition. But if you guys can sort of understand this, hopefully you guys will be able to figure out every other pseudocode out there, kind of, or at least for our purposes. Yay, nay. Hopefully you don't look so confused anymore. Okay, let's talk about programming in Scratch. So in Scratch, if you guys have opened it up and played with it, there's this white rectangle, which is called the stage. That's where everything happens. Like, you know, your sprites, whatever they're going to do, they're going to do it on there. And you can set the background. You can put music there, or you can put music on your sprites or whatever. And I've been talking about sprites. What are they? They're pretty much objects, like a single entity with scripts or code to execute. Interesting. Scripts or code to execute. So these are the things that perform the actions. So they can like change colors, they can bounce around, they can move, they can run into each other, I guess. And okay, so scripts, what do I mean by scripts? They're pretty much a sequence of instructions. So walk 10 paces, turn left, pull out your dueling gun, and have at it, I don't know. And then if you have multiple scripts sort of running at the same time, those would be threads. So threads are like the entire sort of sequence of scripts, or the sequence of instructions. So they're sort of related, but there's I think the scope is different. Threads are like the whole thing, and scripts are the deal with the single instructions all like put together, like one after another. So they're related. Puzzle pieces, or blocks, as I like to call them, they're the ones that allow you to create the action, and they're the ones who implement the programming constructs. So they're the things with like loop, forever, repeat, while, if else, you know, all that fun stuff, all the logic that you need to, you know, perform to give your sprites actions. So yeah, they allow actions and decisions to be made, quote unquote, to be made. So if you haven't played with this already, and if you have some time, and this can be a really big time waster if you really get into it. I've found out way too many times. But this could be fun, and it could also sort of allow you to see how these programming constructs I've been talking about work, or like work in action, if that's not redundant. Question time! What does this script do? And I'll give you the stage. Stage looks like that. I've sort of grayed out the title of the stage or the title of the program so that you guys don't like extrapolate and figure out what it's doing from that. So this script is for this little cube guy here, companion cube, my favorite. So yay, here you can sort of see the programming constructs I've been talking about forever. So this everything inside this forever like C block chunk thing is gonna repeat forever until something else stops it. And what's it gonna do forever? Well, it's gonna move one step. So you can imagine if it keeps on moving one step, it's traveling somewhere. And then here it looks like we're assigning a variable, num, to pick a random number and then assign it to num. So that's what this little orange block is doing. So it's picking something from 1 to 1,000 and assigning it to num. And then it checks to see if num is less than 501, i.e. if it's in the lower half or the upper half of our number range. And if it's in the lower half, we're just going to turn 15 degrees. So the cube is going to turn 15 degrees. And if it's in the upper half of the numbers, you could just do turn 15 degrees the other way, but I was like, oh, I want something cool to happen if you pick the number 1,000, you know, directly. So that's what this if num is greater than 999 is, because our number that we pick is from 1 to 1,000, right? And the only number greater than 999 is 1,000. So I'm just doing a bit of messing around. And if the random number happens to be 1,000, we're going to say, oh no, time froze, and just stop everything. Silly script, maybe so. And yay, you can sort of see the programming constructs here. I've nested two if-elses, so I can have more than just two branches. Now it's like a two branch, and then one of the branches also branches off. And there's the name of my little script, Falling Cube. I can show you it, because I have it open in Scratch, I hope, maybe. Yay, let's see what it does. Let's see if our prediction is right. So the cube is apparently falling like this way into the screen. And now we have to wait until it gets 1,000 and it'll be like, oh no, time froze. Which I guess is kind of rare. Well, I used to do it a lot when I was, you know, when I was testing it. But that ends my slides. Do you guys have any questions, any concerns about the exam, about the final project, about Scratch, about when this is going to stop? Yay, nay? Comments, concerns, anything? Input? It's going to stop soon, I swear. And I was testing it. It stopped within like the first 5 seconds, and I was like, uh-oh. Did I mess something up? Anyway, you can see the number up there. So when it gets to 1,000, there we go. Boom. Randomly got to 1,000. Oh, no, time froze, and everything's like frozen. So that's what that cute little script does. Not sure if it would be good enough for a... Yeah. No, not good enough for the next PSET. But yeah, you guys can do something fun like this. You can make a game. Yes. But yeah, questions, comments, concerns? Want to see other demos? Want to come up here and build your own Scratch project? That'd be kind of fun. Okay, well, if you guys don't have any other concerns or questions, guess you're free to go. Thanks for coming.